I'm running a couple of machines at once.
Are you working out of your home or you have a studio someplace?
Oh no, yeah, I'm at home. So it may get loud. You know, we may hear the fire trucks breeze by. I've tried to limit the at home noise, but let's see how this looks. Oh, it looks good. Okay. It looks recognizable. Yeah. So yeah. So I'm at home. So I'm gonna do a little intro for you and then sort of just get right into the talk. You know, I feel like we've been talking so much lately. This could just be a fun casual conversation about what we do post COVID. And we'll go from there. Is that sound good?
Sounds great.
That's a pretty extraordinary bookshelf that you have in the background.
We had a local, actually it turns out the person, we bought this house from somebody else.
Yeah.
And the people we bought it from had the same carpenter firm put in all their cabinets in the kitchen and completely independent. And we spoke to some of our local neighbors and they said, oh, you got to go see Pelagi. He's the guy who does all this stuff. And they came in and did a great job. So, yeah, we're happy for having books. We got to get rid of some of these books. We got too many of them.
That's always the thing. You know, what do people do with books after they piled up? You realize you're not really referencing them. I'm going through some of that stuff with my publisher right now, just thinking about our books, what they used to be. Do we need to do an audio book? Do we need to, you know, I don't know. It seems like it just takes up a lot of space, but it looks good. most of the people that I've been on Zoom with lately, they've had the fake background, sort of like my background, but it's a bookshelf from somewhere, some hotel, someone's home, you name it. And, but again, it looks good. So let me get right to this. This is an interesting way to do the show. So to everybody listening, everybody tuning in, welcome to Inclusionism. I'm your host, James Felton Keith. This used to be a weekly radio show on WHCR 90.3 FM, The Voice of Harlem. And I got a call from the station managers last week. They said, what are we going to do about your show? You know, you need to record some new shows and send them in to us. And we'll put them on. So everyone who is in Northern Manhattan, in the Harlem area, you can still tune in and find this episode on WHCR 90.3 FM, The Voice of Harlem, on Sundays from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. Eastern, of course. And but we're going to start recording the shows in the middle of the week, a little early, so that we can talk about you know, what we care about most, which is the idea that individuals are at their best when they identify with the community, and that communities are only at their best when they identify all their individuals. And in that spirit, in the spirit of inclusionism, we'll gear these shows mainly around the ills of exclusion and how we try to chip away at exclusion over time, in our own way, in our own spaces. And with that said, this week, we're, you know, coming back again. I've been gone since February of this year. We haven't done a show. And so it's good to come back. I'm at home, sort of recovering from COVID-19. And I've been talking to Stan Altman on and off for the past few weeks. We were supposed to do a show the old way. And just to give you a little background before we dig into everything that Stan is doing right now, Stan is a former president at Baruch College, where he's currently a professor in the Austin W. Mark School of Public and International Affairs. And he's also a board president and have started a new initiative. I don't know, it's not totally new, but a relatively new initiative called Science and Arts Engagement New York, Inc. And they're doing some really interesting things right up here in our neighborhood, but also, you know, all around. So before we get into what Stan's doing, Stan, I think you hold a, you wear a few other hats, right? Are you starting also a new role at City College, aside from the Baruch role? You're sort of a parader of the community system? Yeah.
In fact, as of September 1, I'm going to be on the faculty at City College. I'm transferring from Baruch up to City, primarily because of all the work that I'm doing in Harlem around this Harlem Gallery of Science that we've been working on since 2013.
Nice. I assume that it would be a dual role. Okay, so you're going to leave the Baruch role and just come up to City College. It'll be good to have you around the corner. If you all are in fact there, before we get into other things, what do you think about this fall semester, lecturing? You think you all are going to do a bunch of Zoom conferences, or are you going to actually come down to the city? Or what's your estimation? What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think what's going to happen is that we are not going to move back to the old way of doing classes. Partly because I think we're not going to get fully opened as a city. We're going to continue to have to address the possibility of a resurgence of COVID-19. And therefore, we're going to have to pay attention to these distancing rules between people. I think there's a really good chance that the fall semester is likely to be all online at City College and at the City University. There was a little piece, I think, in the Gotham Gazette today indicating that that's a still undecided issue. But for the summer, it's going to be all online classes. And I think what we're going to see going forward is that increasingly there are going to be classes online. And we're going to be moving away from a strict classroom type model. And so I'm teaching in the Colin Powell School in the fall. Yeah. And I'm prepared to do this strictly online if I have to.
I hear from friends who are in the biz that that is actually a bit more difficult to hold a series of online classes than physical. Or at least they're finding it more work for them, for the teachers, that is. What do you think? Or how is it for you?
I think that's right. No, I think it is harder. I think, for one, when you're in a classroom, you see your whole class. It's easy to identify through body language what's going on in the class. It's easier enough to, call on students. I think one of the things that gets lost in a classroom, it's a little bit more difficult, but if you're really interested in taking advantage of all of the digital media that's now available, I think what I find doing an online class is that I bring together videos and slides so it's more work, but I think you ultimately can create a more interesting product. I do think it challenges us as faculty to really engage our students. One thing I do find difficult and challenging online is that there are so many things going online. Like, for example, the Zoom conference. If there was more than just the two of us, you would be the host. There might be 20 of us, and somebody wants to get your attention. All our mics are off. You got to pay attention to the chat room or somebody putting up their hand. You know, there's a lot of visual activity going on here. And I think that that's the way of the future.
I think we're going to have to get used to it. I remember online classes sort of just starting up when I was in grad school, it being sort of a new thing that we were trying out. Some schools, some professors would opt in for it, but it definitely wasn't the norm. It feels like it was just yesterday, but I guess it was at the end of the 2000s, which again feels like it's yesterday, but I was talking to a bunch of like second year college students about 2 weeks ago, and they were reminiscing about a 2000s party that they had. And I just remember when we were in school, we would have 70s parties. At first, I didn't understand what they meant. We're having a 2000s party. So, well, what does that mean? Like, you know, we're gonna dress up like people did in the 2000s. I was like, what are you talking about? That was 2 days ago. I was one of those people. Anyway, so folks are gonna have to get used to the online learning. So specific to learning and engagement, I think, you know, you having some subject matter expertise, having, you know, led a large institution like Baruch in the CUNY system. Tell me more about the program that you started. I mean, before you get into the actual program pieces, you know, what led you to launch this new company? Is this just as a root of activism? Is it just sort of the, you know, what the emeritized individuals do of the world? What, you know, what got you here? I'm assuming it's activism. What got you here?
Well, it is, I think to some extent it is kind of activism. Partly what got me there is I grew up on the streets of the South Bronx. So I kind of understand what it's like to have no sense that there's a real career out there. No sense that what the world's, you know, possibilities are. I grew up in the 40s and the 50s, but our world was a closed neighborhood. Going to Manhattan was like another world. And it wasn't until I found myself at City College and graduating from City College that I suddenly discovered, wow, there's a big world out there, and there really are a lot of possibilities about how a life can unfold. So being at Baruch and coming back to the CUNY system in 1999 as the dean of the School of Public Affairs, it was clear to me that we deal with a whole generation of young people, a lot of people of color, who really are trying to find their own path. And in many cases, they don't really see themselves as being as capable as they really are. And one of the issues that the university has historically tried to implement has been programs to attract more Black and Hispanic students to the senior colleges. We have a large proportion in our community colleges. And a colleague of mine and I, who were trying to engage students through the arts, kind of met each other up. And in 2013, were approached by a bunch of people from Dublin, Ireland, who had created a program called the Gallery of Science. And the idea was to attract young people into the STEM fields. The Irish government wanted to diversify its economy, get more tech sector build up, needed to build a workforce. And the idea of this gallery was just very creative. And we concluded we ought to do something like that in Harlem, because if we are ever going to attract young Black and Latinx students, we really need to go to where they are. And it's not about finding students who are already in college. It's trying to encourage young people who don't even think that they're entitled to college. If we were going to go into Harlem, we teamed up with City College. And for, I guess, 2 years, the college took the lead over trying to see how we could build this Harlem Gallery of Science. And then the budget problems began, cuts from the state. And so we decided, because the college, the problems began in about 2015.
Okay, about 2 years. Okay.
You know, and the college concluded that it, as much as it wanted to proceed, it really couldn't, because it had so many fiscal challenges. It couldn't invest any more money in this effort. And so my colleague and I decided we would create a not-for-profit. And I said to the president then at the time that we were going to keep doing this. We weren't going to ask the college for any money, but we were going to keep pursuing the idea. So we formed Science and Arts Engagement in 2016. Yeah. We've been moving forward. We've raised money. We've held two exhibitions, one around the science of basketball and one around the science of music, from jazz to hip hop. We are pursuing a permanent space in the tasty lab building that's being put up on West 126th Street, just east of Amsterdam. We're in conversation with Silicon Harlem about sharing space because their goals are very similar to what we're trying to do for the young and youth of Harlem and the upper Manhattan area and the South Bronx, of course, which is where I'm from. Yeah. And we've reconnected with City College so that the college is now actively engaged in this effort to get the gallery going. And that's the reason I'm transferring my academic position from Baruch up to City so that I can continue much more directly work with the community.
I love it.
So that's kind of how it started.
Yeah. And I was going to say, I also love what Clayton and Bruce are doing over at Silicon Harlem. I mean, the many things that they're doing. So might they share some space with you all when you talk about this collaborative effort? How is that going to work? Is this gallery a sort of sustained gallery, or is this sort of an event series that will keep happening over and over again?
Well, we've done a couple of what you call pop-up exhibitions because we wanted to demonstrate to the Harlem community what we actually were talking about programmatically from what the gallery could add in support of the school systems, because the vast majority of people who came to these exhibitions were school kids, middle and high school kids.
Okay.
In the permanent space discussion we're having with the owners of the Tasty Lab building, that's Janus Properties, we would have 21,000 square feet in that building. It would be a gallery, a community space, a maker space, an auditorium, a cafe, a retail shop. And the conversation with Silicon Harlem, and I just had this conversation again with Clayton Banks last night, the president, is that they would physically they would physically have their offices in this space. We would share the community space. We would share the maker space. We would share the auditorium for many of the same things we're looking to accomplish together. And so the idea would be we would much more closely work together. And in fact, Silicon Harlem and Clayton are very involved at the college. They're very involved in, the Greater Harlem Chamber of Commerce, which the college is actively involved in.
Yeah.
The college is trying to get more and more open access and create pathways between the community and the campus. So I think what we're really talking about is finding a way to build a real ecosystem to support the community and support the kids in a world that's becoming increasingly digitally technology driven. So I think, we'll see how all this plays out, but it's getting to be really pretty exciting.
I love it. Folks, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Stan Altman, currently of Baruch, but soon to be of City College, right here in Harlem. And we're talking about sort of expanding the STEAM fields? Science,
absolutely,
technology, arts, engineering, and math?
Right.
I think when Stan and I first talked, I confessed to him that I used to have a problem with STEM fields adding the A, because I used to like to, as an engineer, I used to like to differentiate the technical fields from the art fields. But I think time and maturity helps you see that we are living in an increasingly interdisciplinary world. And so I think it's really interesting what you all are aiming to do in building this ecosystem, here at the neighborhood level. I think so many folks, at least that I meet in my travels and in my talks, talk about things from a macro standpoint. And a lot of those initiatives are usually funding initiatives, but they don't always touch people on the ground where they live. And so the fact that you all are engaging middle and high school students is, much more interesting. And the fact that you all are going to be around the corner for me is endlessly interesting. But are you also doing this stuff in the South Bronx? Are you all have any partnerships over there? Are you looking at any of the schools over there? Or is this right now Harlem is ground zero?
Well, I would say that right now Harlem is ground zero, although when we've done our exhibition, we've reached out to the schools, the South Bronx, Upper Manhattan, as well as Harlem, and invited the teachers to bring their classes to the exhibitions when we've held them. We usually hold 1 hour slots, particularly on the Dunk exhibition where it was physically in place for a month, so that students could come in for 50 minutes and then another class could come.
So you all did the Dunk exhibition when? When was the first one?
First one was March of 2018.
Okay. So March of 2018, what, just tell us a bit more about the Dunk exhibition and what went on there. I think it was fascinating to read about, but what did you all get into there?
Well, essentially we were trying to create, although we had a fairly limited space to work in, some kind of engaging exhibition around a theme students can identify with. So they could identify with basketball. And you don't have to explain to people who basketball players are. They know who they are. If you gave them a chance to, would you like a career in STEM? They'd look at you like you're crazy. Would you like a career in the NBA? They would say, what do I got to do? So we worked out with the NBA to get images. So we had one theme was does size really matter? And so we had an exhibition of the tallest NBA player and the shortest NBA player on one sense. And then we had the tallest WNBA player and the shortest WNBA player. Then we had, does wingspan matter? And we had an image of Kristaps Porzingis with an 8-foot wingspan. And there was a ruler. So students could get up against the ruler and see how their wingspan compared. And then we had Brittany Griner. So everything we did, there was an NBA player and a WNBA player because we were just as interested in encouraging women as we were men. There was does foot size matter? So we had Bob Lanier's sneaker, which was a 24-inch sneaker. He and Shaq O'Neal have the largest sneakers in the NBA.
I didn't know Bob's sneaker that big, but all right.
Oh, yeah.
As big as Shaq, but yeah.
No, it was, it's an amazing size sneaker. And then we actually had Fred Crawford, who had played at St. Bonaventure, who had played in the NBA for the Knicks, the LA Lakers. I think his sneaker was like a 14 or a 15. And he's on our board, actually. He's very active in Harlem.
And then we had. That's sort of a regular shoe size.
What, a 14 or a 15?
Maybe not. Yeah. All right.
And then I think we had one of, if not one of her actual sneakers, I think we had a sneaker that the same size that Brittany Griner wore. We had a hand size, does hand size matter, in which we had various size basketballs with roughly the hand size of what a normal man or woman's hand would look like or a kid's hand would look like, and then the equivalent of what a basketball player's hand would look like. And if you've ever gone and put your hand against a silhouette of Shaq's hand size, I did that once and I found I put the bottom of my hand to the bottom of his hand. And I think the top of my fingers came to above of his palm. I didn't even get over his fingers. He has a huge hand. And then the last exhibit part was something called stretch and jump. And the stretch and jump part was students had, it was a wall where there was an image of an NBA player going to dunk. There was a 45 degree line and basketballs starting at 5 feet and every 6 inches up till 10 feet. And the idea was you took a little magnetic basketball and you stretched as high as you could and you put the ball on the wall. And then you took a second magnetic basketball and you jumped as high as you could and you put that on the wall. And then you took the difference between those two placements. And from that, you could calculate your hang time. And as soon as you started calculating your hang time, you began to talk about mathematics of that calculation. And then we raised the question, what happens if you were on the moon and you had, what would happen in terms of how high you would jump, right? And what would happen if you were on one of the larger planets? And so we then got into a discussion about geometry and about gravity. So we had a fairly good turnout, I think, over the course of the period. We ran into some really cold weather, but we had about 620 people come to the exhibition.
Well, that's a lot. I wasn't expecting that kind of number. Okay.
So I think the idea is we see the gallery as a kind of resource to support what's going on in the schools.
Yeah.
In terms of trying to get students to begin to realize that not only are they capable of engaging these subjects, but that there's a real possible career path to good paying jobs. And
right.
The other part that's important is the gallery serves as a kind of laboratory for City College students who serve as the guides to each of the exhibitions. And so they end up developing learning skills. Now, you and I both know as engineers that one of the things that if we talk to people we knew as our friends, everyday colleagues about what we do, they look at us sometimes pretty funny because we speak in technical terms. And most of these kids who were the guides who came from science and engineering said one of the reasons they took this job was so they could learn to speak to people in lay language, because nobody understands what they say when they talk to their families or their friends. So I think the idea is to get students engaged with things that they really excite them, that they can identify with, that gets them to take what they learn in the classroom and try to apply it to real world situations.
Yeah.
And so ultimately the idea is to get more kids of color into these tech jobs.
Yeah. Now, I love also that the students are learning, because I remember when I started as an engineer early on, but I don't know if everyone listening knows. So I grew up in Detroit, and my first job as a professional, I was designing cars. And I remember this was, early 2000s. This was when the Pistons had a great basketball team.
Right.
2003, 2004, 2005, 2006. And I remember, being really proud. Like I built the car seats and the airbags on the Chrysler 300. I was really proud of, what we had accomplished there. And I was with all these business guys from the marketing team, and they were going to a Pistons game, and they had, these amazing seats. There's a bar under the floor at the old stadium, the old Palace of Auburn Hills. Anyway, I wanted to go, and they were like, I just asked, why don't we get these tickets? Because I wanted to be included with the guys in the suits. They were like, engineers are weird. No one wants to go to a game with them. And I just thought, as I sit here in yellow glasses and a yellow shirt, I'm looking at myself actually looking pretty weird. But I was like, we're not that weird, and I want to go. And I remember at that point, that was probably the beginning of me not wanting to be an engineer and sort of transitioning over into business work. And I would say being in politics now, there was early on a large barrier to get over to understand how to speak in the plainest way I possibly could to communicate the things I really thought to folks. But anyway, your program is of specific interest to me, because I just think kids really don't know what their potential is and what they have the possibility to do until they see it. And I got my career started in engineering because of an NBA legend, Dave Bing, who most people don't know, but after he played in the NBA, he started an engineering company, a manufacturing company. And I was allowed to, as an intern at 18, build car seats on the plant floor at his plant. And that made me decide to go and be an engineer. I didn't know what engineering was going to be. I didn't know that it was going to be, taxing to my lifestyle. At that point, I wanted to sort of party with my frat brothers down in Alabama. But I was only incentivized to sort of move through the program that I thought, might kill me or end my college career, mainly because of the experience that I had at Dave Bing's company building those car seats early on, where someone let me know, hey, this is what engineers do. I just thought, I guess if they can do this, then this is a thing that I can do. So, I'm excited to see how the lab can grow, number one, but also what sort of other programs we could bring in there. Because I remember going to a lot of career days for middle school and high school students and carrying in a car seat. They're not that heavy. They may be about 30 pounds and slamming it on the floor. And, you know, the kids would go, this is crazy. Like, you make this product, this thing that we use every day, and letting them know that, yeah, you can totally do this too. I'd love to see something like that at the lab. So you're building this thing out. You got a bunch of ball players on your board, and you're teamed up with Clayton and company over at Silicon Harlem. What's the next move for, I guess, 2021? Are you all sort of on hold for the rest of the calendar year? What do you think?
No, we haven't stopped. What we were scheduled to do an exhibition on. Well, first of all, I think it's a big mistake for people to think you can suddenly suspend everything and then at some point soon, it's all going to be, you know, hunky-dory and everything will go back the way it was. Right. It ain't going to be, I don't think in our lifetime we're going to see it the way it was. And in a way, that's probably a good thing. Because sure. I do think many of the things we've been doing or have been holding on to the way the 20th century worked. Mm. And we're not in the 20th century. We're 21st century. It's data driven. It's heavy disruption by technology. Sure. It's changed the way we communicate with each other. And we're not fully prepared as a society yet in all aspects of our society to kind of come to grips with those opportunities. Sure. So what the gallery has been doing, we were scheduled to open up the Dunk exhibition on the City College campus on the 20th of April. Obviously, that didn't happen.
Right.
So we're now engaged with a young designer in the South Bronx to build an online version of the Dunk exhibition so people can visit and tour the gallery via online.
That's amazing. So can we make some stuff shareable here? You got any links anywhere that people should go right now? Even if the exhibition isn't up right now, but who's the designer? How can we see him? What's your website? Like, let's just start throwing that stuff out there early.
Okay, well, I think if one wants to get to our website, let me, I'll send it to you. There's a short form version of our web address.
Yeah.
That'll get you to our website. It's just sae-ny.org.
Okay.
And that'll get you up to the website. It'll give you a sense of who we are and our relationships with the various organizations in Harlem and around the city and the state. There'll be some material up and some videos related to the two exhibitions we've done. I don't know if it's talking about we haven't got to the point. We're just starting this development of the online version. So it's, there's probably not much up there yet about that.
Yeah.
We get a sense of who we are and how we relate to City College for one.
Great. I just want people to have a website to reference if they're trying to look you up, if they want to participate, et cetera. So look, I love what you're doing. I'm glad, number one, that you all reached out, because I didn't have any idea. I feel like if I would have known about this back in 2013 or 2015, I would have at least stopped by. But then again, there's always so much going on in the city.
It's right. Just
keep up with who's where. So to go back to something that you said, which I think is interesting, and I feel like I've heard this from a lot of the folks in academia and not so much, to my surprise, from folks in the business community, about the fact that we're likely never going to go back to the old normal. We need to, and so I think with that, would you say, and are you getting at, we sort of, is this an opportunity in your opinion? Are we able to sort of dream up what the next normal is going to be? Is that, I guess, a prerequisite for survival? And I guess, do you see that as an opportunity or not? Or was it where you're going at all?
No, I do think I see it as an opportunity. I think one of the things that this whole experience the last few months around the coronavirus has done is all the things that people haven't been willing to talk about are now right on the table. Mm-hmm. I think it's impossible to read a newspaper, listen to a news broadcast, listen to a radio show without people acknowledging that most low-income communities, whether it's rural or urban, have been harder hit around the coronavirus, because it's not just the fact it's the coronavirus, but because of their living conditions, because of the access to, a lack of access to healthcare, lack of access in many cases to quality food, and even reasonable housing, that they're really vulnerable to all this stuff. And so same issues around education. So we've gone to online education. If I'm a middle-class white kid who've got a computer and, you know, play games all the time, this isn't as big a transition for me as if I'm a kid who grows up in the streets of Harlem, who has no access to the internet or has no computer that it's theirs. So I do think if we're really serious about having a successful country in which the United States, forget for the moment the American dream, but it's just able to play back on the global economic scene, we're going to have to come together and deal with the fact that there's a huge segment of our population who we've excluded from the workforce. We've assigned them to lower income jobs. But if we're going to be tech driven, which we're clearly moving in that direction, we need a workforce. We clearly don't have enough people trained. Yeah. And there's a huge pool of human resources, bright young kids who we've marginalized. And I think part of what we need to do is send them a different message. Rather than saying you can't, I think we need to tell them you absolutely can. You're creative, you have skills, and you bring a different view of the world to the table than I might bring. Or somebody who grew up in a different part of the country might bring. And so I do think it's an opportunity to change things. I think it's an opportunity to begin to stop thinking of various aspects of our life as separate and independent of other aspects. I think as a systems engineer, it's clear things are very interdependent. You can have good health care if you have no access to doctors. You can have good health care if you live in a squalor housing. So the idea of housing and healthcare being integrated is critical. You know, you can't be healthy and have a successful career if you're not educated. In a world where they say you need a college education to get a good job, well, it doesn't start in college. It starts when you're in the elementary and, you know, middle schools and high schools. So I do think we might, this is an opportunity to rethink what we're doing. And I don't mean rethink it from the point of view of just the words, like let's reimagine the world. I think we spend a lot of money that does not produce the kind of results that we think we're investing in. And there is an opportunity to rethink how we both invest our money and how we actually focus on the problems we're attempting to address, rather than just paying to kind of patch over the symptoms.
Yeah, no, I feel the same way. It's funny enough, it's starting to feel like, and I've been trying to use this time to take a step back, but I feel like I'm constantly engaged by these small think tank efforts to talk about just that. Like, if we are to make a new investment, a different type of investment, what does that look like? Or what is the number? Or, you know, how many people are we leaving out and how can we better engage them? But I totally agree with you. I think the number one thing that we should be doing is sort of overhauling investing in people. And that's really a education and healthcare issue, probably the other way around, you know, health first and then radical inclusion in education second. So with that said, what any other things on the burner, any ideas? It may be really quick, it may be a little loud. I feel there's some fire trucks riding past. Now, I don't know if you can hear that.
I hear something. That's fine. Listen, I grew up in the city, in the streets, I'm well aware of. We live on 8th Avenue, not far from a firehouse.
My worry is I'm used to doing this in a soundproof studio. It just feels, I myself am trying to get used to like how crude some of these online communications are. And people from my team and people email me all the time are just like, just do a video, just do it however it happens, just let it flow. I'm like, well, I'm used to things being a bit more, you know, produced and not having, you know, a bird who lives in my air conditioner make noise while I'm trying to, I think there's a family of birds that live in every air conditioner in my building. But anyway, yeah, the noise is gone now. So I'll get back to it. But yeah, so with that effort, what does that look like to you? Is it overhauling education? How does the CUNY, and I don't know if you can answer this question, but take this wherever you want. How does the CUNY pipeline look at or plan to interact with the pipeline of students coming out of middle and high school, not only here in the city, but I know kids are coming from everywhere to go to the CUNY colleges. So is that the fix? Is it just an investment there? Once we've turned them on via the sort of programs that you were mentioning earlier, how do we deploy them into educational opportunity? Are those sort of, is that work that you all are doing? Are those task forces that you all are on? Or, you know, I'm wondering if there's anything in the pipeline, stuff you all are talking about, the decision-making class for New York City.
Well, you know, I'm not sure that the decision-making class for New York City is really discussing these kind of problems that we have to make decisions on. Sure. I do think it has raised, both at the university level and in for the public school system, as well as the privates to some extent, what does it really mean to educate a kid these days? So for one, we need to have to, at a bare minimum, ensure that every household in New York City has access to broadband. Because if they have no access to the internet, even if they were in class, much of the research that students end up doing, most of the words they find, because we don't use textbooks as much, are all on the internet. If I have no access to the internet, I'm already at a disadvantage. I think we need to ensure that every kid who goes to school needs to have, at a bare minimum, a tablet that allows them to access the internet. Or, like in the case of Chromebooks, which are fairly inexpensive computers that serve as front-end terminals, very smart terminals, but front-end terminals. So how do we do that? Well, I think part of the cost of education for kids, just like you have school lunch programs, any kid who comes from a family with income below the, you know, the poverty line, or what, you pick a number, you provide them a free tablet. That's all. You know, it's a little extra cost, but in the big scheme of things, it's a small number for the impact it can have. The second thing I think we need to do is recognize that this is one additional way in which kids get educated, and we need to actually educate the kids how to use the internet, as well as the teachers and the faculty at the universities. Mm-hmm. I often point out that teachers in the public school and in private schools need to get certified by going to college and taking courses to teach. What's it like as a practicum? You go to college, you don't, as a professor, you don't take a class on how to teach. They assume you took a college course somewhere, you know what to do in a classroom, which
that's a couldn't good be. That's a really great point. Yeah.
So I think it's the same issue here. I find we've been doing online education in a variety of ways for at least a decade. Sure. Maybe 10 years ago, we started using Blackboard, which is a system online that's a course administrator. So you post assignments, readings, videos for the students to watch. A lot of students, even today, surprises me, don't know how to use Blackboard effectively. So
I meet everyone who complains about Blackboard. No, but keep going. You're saying? Yeah.
Yeah, I understand why, because it's like a lot of technical things. There's a lot of technical jargon to figure out how to navigate these things. And we don't spend any time really explaining it either effectively to faculty right up front or to students. So part of it is we need to recognize that there's a context in which we're educating people. And everyone needs to understand the context if they're going to be an effective learner or an effective teacher. Mm. And then I think we need to invest to make sure that we've got an infrastructure that can support this kind of education. You know, we've gone through this issue with whether or not Zoom is ultimately the platform, or whether it needs to be WebEx, or whether we use GoToMeetings. I mean, I find myself depending upon whose preference it is, having to figure out how to use at least four different virtual conferencing tools.
Yep.
And half the time I kind of basically understand what I'm supposed to do is turn it on. But then if you ask me to do something, the functionality may be similar, but the buttons are different. The language is different. The placement is different.
Yeah.
So same. I think part of it is we also need to focus on this is what exactly are we trying to do? In trying to educate kids, we're not educating them to keep them in a classroom so that we treat them like we're the babysitter.
Yeah.
It's really to prepare them for a much more fulfilling life and for careers in our workforce. I mean, that's kind of why the City University was created. When City College was created, the leaders of education in New York basically did it for two reasons. They figured they needed an educated workforce if we were going to have a democracy, and we needed to have an educated workforce if we were going to have a vibrant economy, if the city was going to grow from the mid-1800s. And they weren't interested in creating another Columbia or another NYU, because those people who went there already had money. They weren't inexpensive. We were talking about focusing on young people who had the ability to do things but no ability to access a higher education. And so we created City College. And from City College, and then ultimately Hunter, the rest of the CUNY system grew. So I do think it's easy to get lost in all these budget cuts, and I'm not minimizing this, but I think we can't lose sight of the long-term game here. The long-term game is we've got to restructure ourselves if we're really going to carry out our mission. And I think that's what City College is now going through, because it's committed to continuing to do what it was started for in 1847 and figure out a way to reconfigure itself so that it can create these pathways, so that it can have a direct working relationship to the community, so that there is a pathway of engaging young people and inspiring them to be more than they think they are, right? Yeah. Isn't that the purpose of our going to school and working with older people, for them to give us a better sense of who we are rather than the image we have of who we think we are?
I think that is totally the objective. I will say, at 18, we always already think we know who we are.
Until we have our first emotional crisis, right?
Right. Oh, man. 18 seems like so long ago. But when I talk to 18-year-olds now, the confidence that comes off of them, I mean, look, I get it. I try to remember it, but I'm a bit shocked often. But no, so with that said, this is slightly off topic, but I think related. And I don't know if you have anything to add here, but I'd be curious to know, what do you think about the, and I was just asked a lot about this earlier today, about standardized testing here in the city. I mean, any thoughts on it at all? You know, does it work? Can we better implement it, execute it? Is it an opportunity or a barrier to accessing, you know, resources like the CUNY schools? Anything there?
Yeah, I think I don't think it works. I think it's a cheap way of saying you're doing an assessment. There's a very interesting system that the Organization for Economic Development, OECD, created called PISA. It's a performance assessment tool. And what it does is it really engages young people primarily around science, mathematics, and reading literacies in those three fields. And it folds in other topics periodically. They do this assessment every 3 years. And what they want to measure is whether or not students can take what they learn in the classroom and apply it to situations that they've never encountered before. Mm. So, you know, you learn a subject in mathematics, a particular narrow problem about the technique. You give me a standardized test and I pass it. But then I put you in a situation where you have to use it without telling you you have to use it. Can you apply it?
Hmm.
And so I think that whole assessment process is a lot like portfolio schools, where in order to really demonstrate that you've mastered a subject, you have to have a portfolio. And those portfolio products really are much more interdisciplinary. They're not narrow discipline-oriented products. My daughter went to a portfolio middle school.
I was going to say, what's a portfolio? So just define that for us really quick, because I'm not familiar
Well, a portfolio are a collection of the products that you've developed or produced. So right. Some portfolios might include poetry, might include artwork you've done. Portfolio yeah. might include a particular performance media you produce. It might include a research report that you've done. But they're typically oriented around a theme, and yeah. it's your responsibility of pulling together all of the different threads, both through your classroom and the stuff you can research, in order to come to put together that product.
So I didn't know that that was a thing. Is that sort of a, is that a common term in education? That's a type of
portfolio. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
And in fact, most colleges, in fact, increasingly you're reading that a lot of the colleges are concluding they're no longer going to require SAT or ACT scores for admissions, in large part because they don't reflect what you do on those tests, don't reflect your ability to be successful at college. Certainly doesn't reflect your ability to be successful after college. And what they do find is essays by students, letters that they prepare, other things that they've accomplished as more indicative of what that student is like and what their potential might be than taking a standardized test. The problem that we have is life is not simple, right? Sure. I graduated out of an engineering school. You may have experienced the same thing, where in the back of our textbooks, every problem had an answer.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Maybe in some textbooks, it was every other question had an answer.
Yeah.
But life isn't that way, right? There's no one answer.
Right.
You can't find a book that tells you how to solve the problem. Yeah. You need to deal with uncertainty. You need to be able to deal with the fact that things are not neat and clean, that there are interdependencies. It's very difficult to simply separate a piece out without causing unintended consequences that some cases are worse than the problem you're trying to solve. Like, for example, this issue of testing on the coronavirus, right? If the testing errors are 10%, right? And if 10% of the population has the disease, the number of false positives I'm going to get from testing people who don't have it are going to create havoc, because I'm going to have people who think they've got the disease and they don't. So I think the idea of doing standardized tests is a disservice for everybody. And the unintended consequence is that kids are in school not learning how to use the knowledge they're gaining, but how to take a test, which is not really the way life works. And so we're doing everybody a disservice by just doing standardized tests. I realize doing portfolios as a way of assessing skills are probably more difficult.
Sure.
But I think you can, obviously, they do this all over the world. Not just, you know, we're not the only one who faced the issue of how to assess performance. Sure. We don't rank as number one around the world. There are countries whose students do a whole lot better than our students do.
Yeah,
because they focus on educating the whole student, not just their skill taking, you know, their test taking abilities.
Right.
So, I think we need to move away from standardized tests. I think they create a poor environment in the classroom. I don't think they measure what we really are attempting to prepare students for. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they really measure what the student's capable of.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I agree. I didn't want to pad the question with my thoughts on it. I had an opportunity months ago, but I guess over a year at this point, to tour some of the schools in Denmark and look at, you know, how they engage their students. And again, they have some of the highest rates out there of educated people, meaning people with formal educations, but also in looking at the numbers of where they excel, mostly in the liberal arts, but also in technical fields, it really outpaces us by a lot. And I will say, I remember when I got to college, I went to HBCU, I went to Tuskegee in Alabama. Not really by my choice. My parents sort of kicked me out and told me I had to go to Alabama to get away and grow up. But the university really invested in rehabilitating me and teaching me how to write. I went, you know, to be an engineer, and you know, my math skills were solid, but they taught me that I needed to know how to communicate. And then I found myself some years later talking to younger students. I was on faculty briefly at Michigan State University about 10 years ago, and I was meeting a bunch of the students in the philosophy program. I used to help conduct the philosophy club, and there were these two Black students in the club, one guy, one girl, and they both wanted to go to law school, and they were asking me about how to get accepted to the school you really wanted to go to. You know, they were both interested in Ivies, and I think they were shocked by my answer. I was like, you know, I think if you can write a good essay, if you can write a good diversity letter, then I think it can be valued more than the GRE at that point. You know, these right. are students going into grad school, so they'd be taking that particular standardized test. But I just told them, and this is a bit generalized and a bit flawed, obviously, but what I told them in my cynical, having been there, done that point of view was, it's like, I think the best schools are looking to hire some form of politicians, whether you formally go into politics or not. If you're a business leader, you've got to be able to communicate to folks. If you're a lead engineer, you got to be able to communicate to your engineers, whatever it is. And so I couldn't stress to them enough that they should spend a lot more time daydreaming and writing about it, so that when the time came for them to tell a story, they could tell an adequate story or a compelling story to get where they wanted to be. And I don't think that enough people say that to students in general, that, you know, even as they're learning how to code and they're learning, you know, and I'm an engineer, I'm a fan of all that stuff, you know, as they're learning, you know, what algorithms sort of drive us, that the main algorithm that we digest life with and other people's lives with are stories, and that they have to be able to tell a story in order to get their point across to anyone, really, but especially those folks that they really want to sort of influence in their favor. And again, it's something I didn't know until I was maybe, I don't know, 26 or 27 years old. And anyway, so I really appreciate what you all are doing and trying to mix the fields and compare real life to tech, to the arts, to you name it. And I'm really curious to see what this website looks like when it comes together out of this designer in the South Bronx.
So, well, the website's up. I think the thing we're looking for is really to do our first online tour.
Okay. You have an idea when? So when?
Well, we have a target date for I think before the end of June. Let's say the end of June to have it up, so that we can then make it available to schools. Because right. we're expecting that schools are not going to be fully open in the fall. And
so what do you think these secondary schools, like these school children, their teachers will, you know, take a tour as a part of their regular class? Is that a model? Maybe you can hit more people that way. I don't know. I'm thinking out loud. Is that?
No, I think that's a very good question. When we were scheduled to open up the Dunk exhibition on the 20th of April, in March, we went out to the schools. I think we wrote to about 50 schools in the catchment area that I described earlier. Yeah. And we opened up the registration system so you could register for a 1-hour slot Monday through Friday between, I think it was 10 o'clock in the morning and 2 o'clock in the afternoon, because at 2:30, the schools pretty much are let out. And within the first 2 days, we had schools sign up for a total of 350 students to visit the gallery.
Yeah.
When we closed it, we thought about what we were going to do, because this might go on much longer than just a few weeks. And we decided to think about doing this online tour. We wrote to the schools, particularly the ones that had indicated that they were going to come. And we said to them, if we put this online, if we create this, you know, virtual tour or this digital version of a tour, would you bring your class?
Sure.
And they said, absolutely. You know, it's a way of integrating an experience, particularly if we're still online, from the kind of day-to-day thing, just like we take them out of school to go visit someplace. So, yeah, we think, and I do think there's an opportunity for more people to visit. When I talked with the folks at the MBA a couple of weeks ago to let them know we were moving this direction, they said, wow, now that may be an opportunity for more people to visit, not just the area where you physically are located, but anywhere in the country. We can let other schools know that this is there.
And I said, no cities.
That's right. That's right.
Oh, man. No, I think so. You know, with that said, it's 2 p.m. I'm not sure how the engineer back in the radio studio is going to chop and screw this. I usually have a theme song that plays in and out, and they play the station ID at the hour. I don't know how they're going to do that. They'll probably voice it over us. But before we go, and it took me an hour to really stumble on these ideas. So, and we can talk about this a bit offline, but I have a bit of an ask for you to consider. So as you know, my primary work now that my campaign and campaign season is over is really with the data union. And we're a labor union that builds unions around data. And we try to collective bargain, among other things, around the value of data transactions to make sure that we can distribute income back to people who provide data, or classes of people, or as we like to call it, unions of people that provide this information to institutions for their mutual productivity. And as is the case, we launched about a year ago a campus program mainly for college students. And we have a few faculty on our board from you know, Columbia and George Washington and NYU and Cal Berkeley and a few other places, Georgia Tech. And I hadn't really considered middle school and high school or these secondary school students, but they're really the group that we're trying to get to communicate, number one, what data is, number two, how valuable it is, and number three, how it's being used in their everyday life to make decisions about everything that they do, whether they seem like recreational things or critical resources like, you know, health and food and you name it. And we'd love to figure out how to team up and bring our audience to yours and vice versa to sort of expand the education pool around, again, number one, what data is, and number two, how valuable it is, and number three, just how it's being used. I think a lot of people, when they hear data, the next word they think of, at least we have some research that points to this, the next word they think of is privacy. And we want them to start thinking of the next thing after they hear data as valuable. So we think it's increasingly important that we talk to Gen Z, or whatever this newest generation is being called, about this issue. And so I'll definitely hit you up about that, but I'd love to try to figure out how to sync around that issue going forward, because I think it's going to be increasingly important as we look at all the different tech. The fuel inside of it will be someone's data or some group of someone's data. So,
no, I think it's absolutely important. I think the problem with people thinking about privacy when you say data, although I tend to think students tend to think about numbers, right? Is that people don't realize.
So you're right, yeah.
You know, and particularly students who are not fluent in mathematics, they immediately think, I can't do this. And if they thought it was privacy, then it doesn't occur to them that they're giving away their privacy, that they give away so much personal data. that it's really interesting in terms of some of the data questions that have come up. Corporate sellers like Google, Amazon, use their personal data to target products, which means that I'm, in a sense, controlling what you think is available for you to use and buy. Whereas when the public school system needed to figure out if they went online, did they have data about whether or not people had computers or access to the internet? They had no clue. If you would have asked Amazon, who in New York has got access to the internet, they probably could tell you. Google could probably tell you. Yeah. The other thing, it's not an original idea for me, but Phil Thompson, who used to be on the staff of David Dinkins when he was borough president, is now deputy mayor in the city of New York. Phil's idea was, wouldn't it be interesting if communities had access to their purchasing data and they began to look for common patterns of what they bought and then use that information to buy as a cooperative in terms of negotiating better pricing?
I got to talk to Phil.
Absolutely.
Tomorrow. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think, you know, the issue is people haven't realized, that's why they refer to data as the new oil. Yeah. They haven't realized how much value they've given away and how much value they're not, because they're not aware that it's not numbers anymore. The vast majority of data today is unstructured. It's social media posts, it's documents, it's pictures, in ways that we never had access 10 or 20 years ago. So there's a real rich possibilities for data if people really understood what they kept giving away and not using properly.
Totally. Well, no, with that said, I definitely, I'm going to call you. I got to follow up. I need to talk to Phil. Cause that's exactly the sort of thing that, that we're doing. And we have some mechanisms to make it very visible about, again, with that purchasing data example that you gave. I should also say that, in our surveys, we're usually talking to business people and we haven't surveyed a lot of children. So, you know, I wasn't aware that the second thing that they'll think of after they hear the word data is math or numbers. I'm usually talking to professionals and they're sort of, they've been trained over the past 20 years to think privacy next. So, and again, it's all about, you know, what worlds we have access to. So, anyway, thanks for calling in. I really appreciate your time. I want to encourage everyone to Google Stan Altman, just in general, but also check out the website. It's at sae-ny.org, and you're looking for Science and Arts Engagement New York, Inc. And you'll see a lot more about what they're doing. And Stan, I feel like we just sort of touched the tip of the iceberg. Like there's so many extra things we could talk about. So I hope you'll come back maybe when some of this blows over and we're back in the studio. You know, our studio is on campus at City College. So, you know, maybe one day you just come downstairs and we'll continue the conversation for everybody else to hear. But thank you. Thanks.
Thanks, James. Take care. Be well.
All right. You too. Yeah. Be safe up there. All right.
Bye.
All right. Bye.